Okay, everybody hear me? So, I think you're coming back there. Testing 1, 2, 3. The warning. You got everybody back there? In the back? Hello? Testing 1. There we go. Welcome, everyone. Welcome, Dallas Philosophers Forum. We're all the Halloween outfits. Descartes and Aristotle. Maybe not that you can dress up as Aristotle or Plato, you know? Bob, weren't you going to dress up as one of the ancient philosophers tonight in honor of Halloween? No? No, okay. Well, anyway, thanks to everyone for coming out to the Dallas Philosophers Forum. As many of you know, we meet the second and fourth Tuesday of the month.
I'm going to put on a beret and go with Jean Paul Sartre.
Jean Paul Sartre, very good. So if you haven't paid already, it's $5 to our Cara. You can pay her $5 unless you're a student, then it's only $2. Great deal. And also I want to remind you, make sure that you pay your waiter as you leave the pay station there. Every once in a while someone will forget to pay, and we don't want to have to put that bill. So also, if you want to become a subscriber, the cost is $35 for 6 months. We have a website that has a lot of the same information. It's www.philosophersforum.org. And just type in Google Dallas Philosophers Forum, and you can get more information there. So I have a couple of quotes that I want to start off the evening with. And this is in relationship to our need for another volunteer for the Dallas Philosophers Forum. When someone shares something of value with you, and you benefit from it, you have a moral obligation to share it with others. Chinese proverb. The other one, a quote, is from Albert Schweitzer. I don't know what your destiny will be, but one thing I know, the only ones among you who will be really happy are those who have sought and found how to serve. So you have a moral imperative to ask to join the Dallas Philosophers Forum Board of Directors. And if you don't do so, you will never truly be happy. So if you're interested to see one of us, let's raise your hand if you're on the board. There's Ken and David and Carla and myself. So I guess some consideration. We've lost a board member. He went to become a philosophy professor at Ghana. And so we're looking to fill his big shoes. Okay. Last thing I want to mention is please turn off your cell phone and put it on vibrate. Do that now, please. Last time I was here, we had a cell phone that kept ringing over and over and over again. So we want to avoid that situation. I'd now like to introduce our speaker. We're very, very fortunate to have Dr. Justin Fisher, an assistant professor of philosophy at SMU, with us here tonight. He earned his PhD in philosophy from the University of Arizona with a minor in cognitive science. His areas of specialization include philosophy of the mind and cognitive science, as well as metaphysics. In addition, he has numerous articles published. Is the recipient of several philosophy-related awards and is a frequent lecturer in a wide array of philosophy. And he's spoken, this is his second or third time here speaking at the Dallas Law Search Forum. We're very fortunate to have him. His topic today is the possibility of an afterlife. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Justin Fischer.
Got the microphone on?
So,
okay, can everybody hear me?
Keep talking.
I'm supposed to keep talking. So I didn't wear a Halloween costume, but I did put on an orange and black shirt. That was the closest I could get out of my closet.
I can't hear you.
Still having... Oh,
I can hear it now? No.
Great. Okay, are we good?
Yep.
Okay, I guess I just need to talk. Okay, so I'll go ahead and talk, and if you still can't hear me, then make gestures at him, and he'll get it so there he can. Okay, so I'm going to be talking about whether or not an afterlife is possible, and I'll be looking at various different accounts that philosophers of religion have come up with as to how an afterlife might be possible. This is all serious work, but it turns out when you look at these accounts, they seem an awful lot like the sorts of scary stories that we hear around Halloween, so I decided I'd have fun with this and make this be a Halloween version of my afterlife talk. So here's our Halloween edition. So at first blush, it seems like an afterlife, life after death, is a sort of contradiction in terms. It seems like life and death are opposites of one another, so once you've died, you can't be alive anymore. So there's at least a sort of initial reason to be suspicious of this idea of how you could have an afterlife. And so one way you could get around this, and I think this is the way that lots of people have had in mind, is to think, well, what happens when we die isn't really that the entirety of us dies. Instead, there's just a part of us that dies and another part that lives on. I have here a picture of Descartes, because Descartes was one philosopher who worked out this sort of picture of how this might be. And so Descartes thought that we're made up of basically two sorts of components. So first there's our physical bodies and our physical brains. But Descartes thought, well, in addition to all that, there's something more. There's this sort of thinking substance that does our thinking, has our experiences, does our feeling, makes decisions for us. For Descartes, this was not located in space, and so it didn't have spatial extension, so it'd be hard to show on a monitor. I will just show this thinking substance as a ghost, sort of following the philosopher Gilbert Ryle used the expression ghost in the machine. In fact, here's a B-grade movie poster. This is the first in a series of B-grade movie posters that I'll show you, the ghost in the machine. So this was Descartes' understanding of how we were related, how our minds and our bodies were related to one another. Descartes thought, well, really, we are this sort of ghostly thinking substance, we're sort of temporarily associated with our bodies, so that as things happen to our body, messages get sent from our brain to this ghostly thinking substance. Descartes had done autopsies on brains, and we have a whole lot of bilateral symmetry, so you have one eye on this side and another eye on this side, and the brain's the same way. That most components of your brain, you have one in your left hemisphere and one in your right hemisphere. But Descartes noticed, well, there's this pineal gland right in the middle that doesn't seem to be mirrored on the other side of the brain. So Descartes thought, well, that must be the sort of central point where the messages go and get sent up to the ghost. And so Descartes thought, well, that's how we sort of understood how nerves work. Not real well, but he could see that messages would get passed up nerves, and so he thought they would get passed up nerves eventually to the pineal gland. That would send the message to the ghost. The ghost would have conscious experiences in response, would feel pain, would feel love, would make decisions, and the ghost would eventually, after it decided what to do, send the message back down to the pineal gland, and then that would get sent out from nerves to the muscles of the body. And would make you behave in response. So this is Descartes' picture of what the relation between our mind and our body is. And so if you have this sort of picture, an afterlife might seem possible. So here, or let's tell a little story. So it was a dark and stormy night. Descartes and his body go out for a walk. And out of the mists arise rabid philosophy fangirls. I don't know about you, but if I had to meet my untimely demise, I think this is a pretty good way to go. So the rabid philosophy fangirls rise up out of the mist and they say, OMG, it's Descartes, and they pounce. And they tear Descartes apart, limb from limb. And this looks like the end for Descartes, except it isn't really, because if Descartes really just this ghostly thinking substance, then the loss of the body might be an inconvenience, might be a setback, but it's not really the end. Descartes still alive, the ghost's still there, even if his body has gotten torn apart. And if his ghost moves on to afterlife and then maybe conveniently gets hooked up to some other body, maybe it's even a better body than Descartes had originally, then it seems like, well, here's a possibility for Descartes to survive the death of his original body and go on and have an even better body in heaven. So there would be at least one picture of how an afterlife might possibly work. The main problem with this picture is there's an even better movie, the only non-B-grade movie that I'm going to show you in this. And this movie, scientific evidence has given us a pretty good reason to think that this isn't really what's going on. This isn't really the way that our minds work. So we have a quite good understanding of how our brains work. We can identify different parts of the brain that are responsible for different aspects of our cognitions, and we can identify which parts of the brain feel the sensations from touches on different parts of your body. We can identify which parts of your brain are responsible for emotion and memory and decision making and stuff like that. And what we can't find any signs of are this downward arrow here, any signs of outside messages being sent into the brain from someplace else. Pretty good sense of the brain has hundreds of billions of neurons in it, hundreds of trillions of synapses. This seems to be plenty enough complexity to produce the amount of complexity of behavior we see in human beings. And so at least of now, we don't have any evidence that there needs to be something more, this ghostly something extra. And so there's this common rule of reasoning that probably all of you have heard before, Occam's razor, which suggests that you should prefer the simplest explanation that you can come up with that's capable of explaining the things that you've observed. And in this case, it seems like the simplest explanation is that our brains are what's responsible for our cognition, our decision making, and that there isn't something extra. And so that suggests that we probably shouldn't accept. You know, it may be that if we had this extra ghostly thinking substance and that really was where our personality dwelled, then maybe there would be some hopes for an afterlife, but at least right now, we don't have any evidence that things work that way. So what to conclude in light of this sort of scientific findings that seem to weigh pretty strongly against accepting this first way that an afterlife might work out? Well, what I'm going to do through the rest of the talk is consider some various suggestions that different philosophers of religion have been really moved by the scientific evidence, saying, wow, I don't think that we probably do have this sort of ghostly thinking substance, they're interested in accounting for how an afterlife could be possible, and so we're going to look at some of the proposals they've made that try to reconcile this sort of purely physical picture of what we are like with the possibility that we might still live on after our deaths. So we'll talk about those. So the first one of these, end up retelling the story each time, so it was a dark and stormy night. Descartes, this time Descartes just a physical body, because we aren't assuming he has a ghostly thinking substance anymore. Descartes goes for a walk. The rabid philosophy fangirls rise up out of the mist. They pounce, they tear him limb from limb. And now it looks like it really is the end for Descartes, because he doesn't have this ghostly part of him that could live on after this horrible, gruesome stuff happens to him. So let's go ahead and continue the story the same way anyway and see how it would work out. So suppose up in heaven there's this other body that's created that's quite a bit like Descartes' original body was. We don't have a ghost anymore because we aren't believing in that. But maybe this is enough for Descartes to live on in heaven, that there was the creation of this body that was a lot like his original body. Okay, so here's a movie poster version of this, Attack of the Clones. It's a Star Wars, the second prequel poster. Definitely a great movie. This idea has been advocated by Dean Zimmerman, who is a philosopher of religion at Rutgers University. Okay, so the biggest concern I think about this proposal is that it seems like this guy that's created up in heaven, even if it's a lot like the original Descartes, it wouldn't actually be Descartes. It would just be some other guy that was a lot like the original Descartes. And so here's one way of seeing that. Suppose we rewind the tape, so we go back through the fangirls demolishing the original Descartes, and just imagine that we have the original Descartes intact, and we create this other guy a lot like him up in heaven. Well, clearly, this other guy isn't the original Descartes reincarnate. That's not Descartes living on. These are just two separate people who are a lot like one another, sort of like identical twins, or maybe closer than that, depending on how alike the blue circled version is to the red circled version. They're just different people who happen to be a lot like one another. It might be reassuring to think that when I die, somebody will be created who is a lot like me, but that's not a way for me to survive my death. Here's another way of seeing that same idea. Suppose that not just one copy is created, but two copies are created of the original Descartes. That's not going to, here's one way of seeing that this can't be the same individual as well. It can't be that both the blue one and the green one are identical to the red one, because if they were, they'd be identical to each other. But look, they've got to be separate individuals standing next to each other. It can't be that Descartes has an afterlife as the blue one and the green one both, because they're separate individuals, so Descartes can't be the same person as both of them. If you're thinking that Descartes is going to live on as just one or the other, just creating a copy of Descartes isn't going to be enough to get him to live on, because if you create two copies, that wouldn't be enough to get him to live on in both of them. Okay, so those are the big concerns I think about this sort of account is, at best this is a sort of reassurance that after I die, somebody sort of like me, or maybe quite a bit like me, would live on if this sort of thing happened, but it wouldn't be a way for me, myself, to live after the death of my body. Okay, so if that way's not going to work, let's go on. So we are our third telling of the story. So it's a dark and stormy night. Descartes goes for a walk. The rabid philosophy fangirls rise up out of the mists, and they attack and tear Descartes apart. Now the problem last time was, it seemed like if we just build a new body for Descartes out of completely separate parts, it's not connected enough to the original Descartes for it to seem like that was him living on. So in this case, let's suppose after the fangirls leave the remnants of Descartes behind, so we have this corpse of Descartes here, let's use those parts so we'll have more continuity between the original Descartes and the body we're going to recreate. So let's take all these parts of Descartes' corpse and somehow put them back together into the shape of a person, and somehow we'll bring that person to life, and we can let them go live in heaven afterwards. Maybe here's a way that you could have an afterlife occur by sort of reanimating the corpse of the dead person. Here's a movie poster version of that. The dead will rise, the killer be killed. And I don't know of any contemporary philosophers of religion who actually advocate this. This is basically, if you try to literally read the biblical prophecies about what the end days will be like, that's at least a very natural reading of these, basically the corpse rising up out of the ground again. So that's at least a picture of how the afterlife might work. Concerns about this one. One concern is basically the same concern we have before is, just because we put back together using parts of, say, me after I've died, That would be a person that was created afterwards, it seems like. But would it be me again, just because it contains my parts? It seems like there, you know, there's a real worry that what you would have created afterwards is some new person that just happens to reincorporate the same material as the old person did, but it's not a way for the old person to have survived on. So that's one sort of concern about this. Another concern is that it seems like the logistics just aren't going to work out. So to see that, suppose the fangirls are not just rabbit philosophy fangirls, they're carnivorous philosophy fangirls. So they actually ate all the pieces of Descartes, and so these were incorporated into their bodies afterwards. And so then someday they're going to die, and I guess presumably they're going to need to go to hell if this is the sort of thing that they do. And so we have a problem, because all these parts that were parts of Descartes, they need to go to heaven because they're parts of Descartes, but they also need to go to hell because they're parts of the fangirls, and the logistics aren't just going to work out. And this isn't just cannibalism. You know, this is the cycle of life. You know, whenever anybody dies, you know, you get buried, bacteria eat your body, the material gets reincorporated into the ecosystem, and eventually is going to be in other people's bodies. So the logistics just aren't going to work out on this for thousands of years of history. So it seems like there are multiple reasons to think this sort of account of the afterlife couldn't actually work. Okay, so we'll go on to our fourth and final telling of the story. So it's dark and stormy night, Descartes goes for a walk, the rabid philosophy fangirls rise up out of the mists and pounce, and now we're going to pause the story right here. Now the problem with the last story was that, one problem was that as soon as Descartes dies, then it seems like, well, even if we put the pieces back together, that won't be continuous enough with the original Descartes for it really to be him that's living after we reanimate a new corpse out of this stuff. And then there was also the concern that if we let his pieces go on and get incorporated into the ecosystem, the logistics just couldn't work out to reanimate all the corpses later on anyway. So we can avoid all these problems if we can just snatch Descartes out of the picture. So this is the proposal that Peter and Van Inwagen has made, is that just as the Descartes about to meet his demise, this the body snatcher comes in and snatches his body away, takes it up to heaven, and so it was the original body of Descartes. He didn't actually die; he got snatched away. Up into heaven, and so there isn't the problem of this being some new individual that's created that's just a lot like him. Though this is him. He got literally snatched away and moved up to heaven. So here's the poster version of this, the invasion of the body snatchers. Here's a picture of Peter Van Inwagen. He's a leading philosopher of religion at Notre Dame University. Okay, so I guess one obvious problem with this is that the philosophy fangirls are going to be frustrated. Their philosopher just got away, and they're going to notice that they didn't actually get to tear their philosopher apart. And so Van Inwagen has a story about this, about why it seems like people actually die rather than they get snatched away. And his story is, well, the body snatchers have prepared a corpse. It looks just like Descartes. And quickly, faster than any of our scientific instruments can detect, they bring this corpse in there, and so now the philosophy fangirls actually do have something to pounce, so we actually do have corpses that are there to observe after people die, or I guess just appear to die, because they don't actually die, they get snatched away for their afterlife. And I guess this could maybe all happen faster than any of our instrumentation could detect. It would have to be pretty darn fast, I guess. In theory, at least, this, it's a far-out possibility, but it's still a possibility. So at least as far as I can tell, this is a coherent way that an afterlife could work. But I guess, once again, this is another one of those Occam's razor cases, that if we don't have any evidence that the body snatchers are coming in and replacing living people with look-alike corpses, we probably shouldn't believe that that sort of thing is happening to us. Okay. So I'll give you a quick summary, and then I'll give you three conclusions. So first, in summary, we've talked about four possible ways an afterlife might work. One way is that, well, we might have this ghostly thinking substance as a component of us that survives the death of our bodies and goes on to an afterlife, but we saw that we don't have any evidence yet that our minds include anything like this, and so that sort of story we're not so sure about. Second possibility would be that, you know, as we die or after we die, a clone of us is created up in heaven, and that this clone is enough like us for this to count as us going on to live in an afterlife. Third possibility is that after we die, eventually the matter of our corpses gets somehow reincorporated together and reanimated, and so that's us going on to live in an afterlife. And the fourth possibility is, well, maybe right at the moment of our apparent death, this body snatcher comes in and snatches our bodies away, and our body continues living in the afterlife, and some lookalike corpse is dragged in for everybody else to see and be misled into thinking that we've died. Okay, so those are the four possibilities that we've talked about. The first conclusion here is a couple of these stories, I think, just won't work out. The cloning story, well, that would be a way of having somebody who's a lot like me live after my death, but it wouldn't be a way for me to survive my death. Similarly, years later, putting back together all the matter that had incorporated my body, that would be a way of creating somebody new who probably wouldn't be me, and even if you thought it would be me, you'd have logistical problems trying to do this for everybody, given the way that matter gets reused in multiple bodies. So that possibility's not probably going to work out. But second conclusion is, well, there were these other two accounts. So one account holding that we have the, you know, our personality lives in this extra ghostly thinking substance that we haven't been able to detect yet, and that survives the death of our body and goes on to get up to a new body. It's a way that an afterlife probably could work out. And also this possibility that we're just physical bodies and they get snatched away by the body snatchers right at the last moment. And so our bodies get to go on and live on after our apparent death. That seems, I'm not sure it's an afterlife exactly, but it's, I guess, immortality. It's a way of faking your own death and living a lot longer than it seemed like we lived, which is quite a bit like having an afterlife. And both of those, it seems to me, these are at least possible ways that an afterlife could work out. Ockham's razor suggests, well, we really shouldn't believe in these until we have evidence of these. At the moment, the simplest explanation for the sorts of things we can see doesn't require us to have any of the fancy footwork that's involved in either of these stories. So at least for now, we should be very skeptical about these and probably not believe them. Mm-hmm. My third conclusion is, whatever else you might think about philosophy of religion, at least it's a damn good source for Halloween stories. Okay, and I guess we'll do some questions now.
Okay. Yes.
Have you done any reading or writing or research into the idea of a digital afterlife?
Is it mic on?
I'm not sure that the mic was on. I can repeat the question, though. She asked what I thought about a digital afterlife. To me, actually, I think this is the more promising sort of way of trying to get an afterlife to work. I think probably philosophers of religion have thought about it less, just because it doesn't seem at all like what people thousands of years ago, as they were writing religious texts, depicted the afterlife as being like. And so it wouldn't necessarily be of much help to somebody who has a religious story that they're trying to preserve. But it might be a way for you to be hopeful that you could survive the impending death of your flesh and blood body, is somehow to hope that you could get your brain scanned and that sort of pattern of brain activity somehow installed in a computer. One worry about this is going to be the same sort of worry that we have with the cloning example, is would this be a way for you to live on as opposed to a way of creating something else that depending on your views of philosophy of mind, a lot of philosophers of mind think that you know, as long as you get the same pattern of functional organization going in the computer, that you had going in your original brain, that would be a way of having a mind that was just like your original mind. But the tough question is, would that just be a clone who's a lot like you, or would it be you yourself living on in the computer? And probably the best case for that is going to be one where it's some sort of slow substitution. So you can imagine, sort of the way, just getting the story earlier about, I'm sorry, I forgot your name. Paulette. Yeah, I was going to guess it right, actually. You were telling me the story of your cousin who had her knee replaced with a metal knee, and you could imagine somebody having their neurons replaced with silicon neurons, and if you did that one at a time, eventually you might have your brain replaced with neurons that won't have the same sort of life expectancy that your current neurons have, and so maybe that would be a way of getting at least near immortality that way, and would be continuous enough that we wouldn't worry that we just created some clone of you, that it actually was you living on, just like we think Paulette's cousin is still the same person despite the replacement of her knee with this metal replacement knee. And so if you did that, that might be a way that we could hope to overcome the sort of limitations that the limited lifespan of our flesh and blood bodies have. So to me, that's one of our best hopes now. Will that technology arise in our lifetime? Probably we're all out of luck, but maybe our kids or grandkids can hope for something like this as a way of living a whole lot longer than any of us are capable of living.
But why?
Why would you want to do that?
Yeah.
I don't know. It's
I mean, we're crowded enough.
Yeah. No, there are real worries that if people stop dying when we get too crowded right away, and you might worry that even if we could afford to do that, even if we have the technology to do that and we could afford to do it, it might be a dumb idea anyway. And I think that would be a different talk. I guess here I was just sort of interested in the question about whether or not it's even possible for an afterlife to occur, and just how crazy the story, the logistics would need to be to get it to work out. If we discovered that it was possible and we had a way of doing it, then there are going to be all these ethical and practical questions about whether we ought to do it. And I don't know. I think I can see strong cases in each direction, it seems like. You know, the fact that people die, many people think that's a bad thing. Killing other people, definitely, we usually take to be one of the worst crimes that we can do, and so if we can find ways to avoid death, seems like there's quite a bit morally to be said for doing that. That, as you mentioned, we'll have to keep population levels in check somehow. And if it's not by people dying, all the alternatives don't seem that good either.
You have to stop new births.
Yeah, that, I guess that's probably the main other alternative.
Isn't no more sex then, right?
Yeah.
No sex.
Maybe once you get plugged into the digitalized machine, you can have cyber sex with artificial partners, and it'll all feel a lot better. This is probably just as dystopic a picture as the other ones we have.
I don't believe in the dualism of part, and I don't think that our personality is beyond its life, Aristotle. Once the brain's dead, our personality's dead. But no one has ever come back from an afterlife to tell us about it. But it's a non-scientific thing. You can't set up an experiment to prove or disprove it. I think it was Blaise Pascal that said if he was a betting man, and he bet if there was or wasn't an afterlife,
Or mortality.
That he would bet that there was, because if there wasn't, then it didn't matter. But if he bet against it and there was, then he would be a loser. So what do you say about that?
Yeah, so you're talking about Pascal's wager, the idea that the safest bet is to bet that God exists, because if you're right, you'll get to spend eternity in heaven, and what can you win by betting that God doesn't exist? At best, you'll just avoid needlessly going to church and tithing and stuff like that. But he thinks even a small chance of heaven definitely outweighs these costs. And I guess to me, if I felt confident that was all that would determine my afterlife, is whether or not I believed in God's existence, that was my ticket for getting into heaven, then I You know, I still have a hard time believing something without any evidence, but I at least feel pulled by the argument. It seems like the real concern with this is that there are lots of different things that we could imagine being rewarded or punished. There are lots of different gods. Lots of people in the world believe in a god that if you, at least if you're a woman, if you don't wear a burqa through your life, you won't be able to go to heaven, and yet I don't see anybody in here wearing a burqa. And so Pascal's wager, even if that persuaded you to believe in some sort of god, it didn't persuade you to believe in the sort of god that Muslims believe in. So it seems like there are all these different possible gods with different sorts of things that they might reward, and Pascal's wager doesn't give you any way of choosing between these, and even on the extreme end of this, you can imagine a sort of a hermit god who doesn't want people to believe in him, and maybe that fits with the lack of evidence for God that we see around us. And so this god rewards atheists with a heavenly afterlife and punishes his theists by sending them to hell for having believed without evidence in a god. And it could be that sort of god exists, and so atheism is your safest bet. So to me, we just don't have enough information about what the rewards might be for Pascal's wager to push us one way or another.
And if God is omniscient, you don't know you're faking it. That's recording.
Yes, so you might get screwed by being persuaded by Pascal's wager anyway. Yeah.
What you were saying that the ghost of the machine, of course, makes me think of Hamlet, and in Hamlet he signs a letter to Ophelia, Hamlet, while this machine is to him. And so he's thinking about that, obviously, but he's also famous for the to be or not to be speech, and he's considerations of the afterlife and the fact that one doesn't know what that afterlife is like, and that is a deterrent. But I guess my question is, how much is this concern about whether we survive our death or live on after our death, how often is that actually tied to a concern about what the afterlife is like itself? Or do those tend to be two completely different investigations that philosophers will tackle differently?
Yeah. I guess the sort of debate I'm engaging in here, the sort of sequence of it is, people start off being dualists, we get the scientific evidence that suggests, hey, we don't need to be dualists, the simplest explanation of our cognition is that it's our brains that are doing it, and we have no evidence of the ghostly extra stuff, so we probably ought to stop believing in that. And then the question is, does that force us to stop believing in an afterlife also? And so people like Zimmermann and Van Inwagen were basically trying to say, well, even if we are physicalists, except that we're just physical bodies, no ghostly stuff, there's still at least a possibility, a theoretical possibility of an afterlife. And so that's the debate I was sort of presenting here, because it gets these interesting ghost stories and other sort of body snatcher stories about how even the logistics could work out for an afterlife there. But you're definitely right that if we could persuade ourselves, yes, an afterlife is possible, and I think technically it is possible in these two ways, then there's the questions about, well, how likely is it that we will have an afterlife, and what sort of afterlife should we expect, and is there anything that we should be doing differently in light of the fact that we might be having an afterlife? Should we be living our lives differently now in hopes of getting a better afterlife, the way that Pascal thought that wagering on God's existence might be his take to a better afterlife. And that's going to raise lots of other really hard questions, where here I was mostly just trying to say, this afterlife part of lots of people's religious views, can we make sense of that? Is that compatible with what we know about how our minds work? And it seems like here the answer is probably not, and only in very outlandish ways that we have no evidence that things actually work that way. And for me, at least, it was interesting exploring the sort of things and seeing just how outlandish things would actually have to work in order for an afterlife to work out. That, to me, was interesting enough that to me, even this is enough, I think, to start being pretty skeptical about our having an afterlife. But if you think, maybe we do have an afterlife, then you have lots of further questions about what would the afterlife be like. I haven't tried to answer those. I'm not sure how we even could answer those. So.
Great question, Mike. Yeah, Justin, by the way, I remember that I had heard this before. Anyway, to expand a little bit on what Sally said and slightly modify, would you consider a fifth option that we are a computer simulation in a higher level universe? The implementation of the afterlife is when you croak, you go to a previous checkpoint and just move that entity up into a different part of the simulation.
Good. Yeah, I'm not sure. Sometime somebody might get me to give a talk here or something about Nick Bostrom has given an argument for thinking that there's a good chance we are computer simulations like that. And I at least have a hard time figuring out what's wrong with that argument. And so at least in lots of moods, I'm sort of persuaded that there is, you know, I'm not sure people have run the numbers. David Chalmers has run the numbers and come up with something like a 20% chance we're living in a matrix. And I'm not sure that the numbers are exactly that, but that's still a pretty significant chance that we're like that. And if that's the sort of beings that we are, it seems like, well, maybe that gives us a better chance having an afterlife. I'm not sure. It still depends on what the nature of this computer simulation is. That's a worry that it'll get turned off. You know, if our nature in the computer simulation is, the computer simulation is this really detailed simulation that simulates all the atoms in our bodies, and our minds just emerge out of that pattern of organization, and it doesn't really matter whether I'm made out of sort of fundamentally physical atoms or computer simulated atoms, still once those atoms stop having the sort of homeostatic living organization that they have now, it seems like that's going to be the end of me, regardless of whether I'm in a simulation or not. But if you think the simulation doesn't really have that sort of structure, that it's a sort of low fidelity simulated world with some simulated consciousnesses that are fed inputs from that world, so this would be more like there's a Spanish movie, Open Your Eyes, or I think the American remake of it was called Vanilla Skies, but the sort of simulation that's involved in that sort of scenario rather than a matrix scenario. That one seems to offer a lot more prospects for our being able to live after the after our apparent deaths, if that's the sort of simulation we're living in. I class that with these other sort of question mark ones where it's a very complicated story that at the moment, even if you're persuaded by Bostrom's argument to take some computer simulation hypotheses seriously, whether it's the sort of hypothesis that would also involve an afterlife, it seems like at this point we don't have much evidence of it. But yeah, I class that as another possible way that it might happen. But at the moment, I don't have enough evidence to take it real seriously.
What, if anything, do you make out of the near-death experience accounts? I don't know if you saw it, but there was one on the cover of Newsweek this last issue that happened to be by a neuroscientist.
Newsweek's about to change over to electronic only, isn't it? So I stuck paying attention to their paper one. So I don't know that story in particular. The near-death experience stuff that I have seen seems to be like brains in very unusual traumatic experiences producing delusional experiences and or delusional memories as though of having had experiences. And we know that brains do that a lot, and these are, you know, very good circumstances for that sort of delusion to happen. To me, it doesn't seem like it gives us any sort of strong evidence as to what would happen. The best evidence that you could get in this ballpark, and people have made claims in this way sometimes, is, you know, if you really could get well-confirmed evidence of somebody getting access to information they shouldn't have had access to, then that would start to convince me. And people have sort of set up experiments where they'll put different symbols up on the top of bookcases in hospital rooms. So if somebody did have an out-of-body experience and float up, then the idea is we'll ask them afterwards, oh, what symbol did you see? Thus far, there hasn't been any convincing evidence of this. Part of the reason is that these sorts of experiences just don't happen very often at all, and so they don't have the experiment set up in enough hospital rooms to detect it. And, you know, partly just the fact that they don't happen very much at all is sort of an indication. We get a really strong confirmation bias from hearing the glowing stories of somebody who said something that turned out to be more or less true. And that's the story that gets broadcast everywhere, whereas we don't hear about all the other cases where it doesn't happen. So to me, I'm really skeptical about all of this. I haven't been convinced by anything yet.
The argument this particular gentleman makes is that he didn't have enough brain activity to have a delusion. He was convinced as a neuroscientist that he was incapable of generating a delusion during the week that he had these experiences.
Yeah. I think maybe I have read about the same guy, though I haven't read the Newsweek story. And the sort of concern, if it is the same guy, that arises here is whether he is confabulating after the fact what he claims to have remembered. And if it is the same guy, it took him quite a while to come up with a story. And even when you read the story, if you read what he actually said, it took me a really long time to come up with words for what it was. So it seems like this is, you know, a pretty... it's a sort of case where it seems like it might well be confabulation, that he's struggling to come up with a narrative afterwards for what had happened. And, you know, we have lots of other evidence that brains confabulate all the time. And so to me, that's probably what's going on in this case also. I would need evidence to convince me that, you know, if the story is that he got to go to heaven and experience a sort of heavenly experience and got to bring back messages from God, if it's the same guy. You know, that's a really remarkable story, and I would need really remarkable evidence to be convinced of it.
You were talking also as a possibility of...
What's on?
Possibility of living on in a body as well. And it went through my mind, I wonder, you know, at what age could I choose to be 20 years old? And I don't want this old man's body when I live on.
Yeah. Well, that might be a real worry for the sort of Zimmerman style, where he's saying it's the similarity of the clone that's created, where he's sort of saying that at the moment of the death of your body, whatever is the best candidate for being you living on, that counts as you. And so if it's the clone that's created, now if that's how the afterlife actually works, you might be stuck with, maybe not your old body, maybe it's similarity of your brain that matters, but at least your old brain, you can't go back to your, to me, right?
It would be nice to have my old brain and my new body.
Yeah, I'm not sure. It seems like... there's some aspects of my younger brain that I like to have. I feel a little foggier in some ways now, and I fear it's just going to continue that way as I get even older. It seems like there's the real worry with the Zimmerman style approach that for him it's the similarity between the clone and the original that makes the clone count as the original having lived on. And so that doesn't allow for as much optimism about, how much better my heavenly body and even my heavenly mind is going to be than this one I have here.
Yeah, I kind of like the quantum entanglement argument that as long as anybody is alive who ever knew me, I'm still alive. And as long as anybody is still alive who ever knew them, I'm still alive. In other words, well, my consciousness, as I perceive it now, doesn't last forever. What I do with it does, essentially, although it's eventually it's spread out so that it's almost invisible, but never, it's like a wave across the ocean, never really disappears, it just becomes unmeasurable. And I think I agree that I don't believe I'm enjoying my life in my seventh decade as much as I did in my second or third. What must it be like in my fifth century if this progression continues?
That's a real worry. I have those sorts of worries about Pascal's wager also. Is it eternity in heaven? Is that really infinitely good? To me, diminishing returns would probably start to kick in eventually. So you were thinking that...
Jeff Hofstadter came up with that idea.
So you were suggesting there's this sort of quantum entanglement, and I can see how... I can take some solace in the fact that I've interacted with other people and that there's this sort of ripple going across the ocean still that's a ripple that I caused even after I die. But that to me, doesn't strike me as a way for me to survive my death. And especially if you don't think that you're going to have any conscious experiences after your death, then you know, there's some solace I take in the ripple. You know, as I start thinking about the ripple getting smaller and smaller, the further out it gets, it actually starts to feel a bit discouraging, actually noticing how little difference I'll have made in the grand scheme of things. But still, there's some difference I've made, and maybe that's a little bit heartening.
Woody Allen's idea was, I don't want to be immortal because of what I've done. I want to be immortal by not dying.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great lie. I should figure out a way to put that in.
Sorry, we're all going to do it.
There's ample documentation of near-death experiences where people come back with information they couldn't possibly have known from where their body was. There's also a well-documented near-death experience from a guy, I don't know his name, but he's got a big old long testimony, and he came back with new information that either NASA or some other institution has hired him to develop technology based on. And that's documented, and you can find it if you look for it. It's out there. So how do you explain that?
Well, I don't know about the second case. I'll be more impressed if he actually develops the technology than I would be that he commits somebody to hire
him.
But yeah, and I guess in that case he'd still have worries about, well, maybe he was creative enough to come up with it even without having acquired this information and he died. You'd said before that you thought there was ample evidence of people acquiring information in near-death experiences.
Yeah, there's lots of documentation.
It may be that you'll find some that convinces me. The stuff I've seen so far hasn't convinced me, so maybe just to talk about one of the most famous examples, and I can't remember her name, but it was a woman who claimed to have seen a shoe up on a ledge that allegedly was too high for her to have seen from her hospital room, unless she had sort of ascended during her near-death experience. And then afterwards there was a shoe there, and at least in this case, when people went back to look at this, well, it turns out the shoe wasn't nearly as hard to see as it was originally made out to be, and it could well be that she had heard people talking about the shoe, that she had seen it herself, or that she just made a lucky guess. So that, at least when I looked into this stuff about a year and a half ago, that was what seemed to be the best case that people had, and even that one, once the researchers went and looked to see, well, how hard would this case be, it didn't seem to be a very convincing case after all. Now, maybe that I just haven't been exposed to the right cases. Again, this is the sort of thing that the claims are really remarkable, that people could detect things not using their sense organs, which we have a pretty well understood story about. Here's how we can gather information via our eyes and have that incorporated in our brains and talk about it later. To think that, well, we have some other way of rising up out of our bodies and seeing things when we're nearly dead, would take some really convincing evidence to convince me that that's what was happening rather than some sort of delusion or lucky guess on the part of the person. And I haven't seen that sort of remarkable evidence yet.
Here's another scenario to think about. Science is helping us live longer and prolong our life, and maybe a long time, maybe 1,000 years, maybe, quote, immortal. And therefore, you know, instead of an afterlife, it's an in this life. Was it Bram Stoker or whatever, conversation with the vampire, about the vampire that lived on and on and on and on and on. You know, and this vampire was tired of living all this time and experiencing everything. And can you imagine if we were in, quote, a heaven or somewhere else, living in eternity? What in the world would we do all that time?
Yeah.
You know? Those are things to think about. If we lived on this life 1,000 years, I mean, how many wives or husbands would we have? You know, that sort of thing.
I think there are lots of tough questions that I didn't get into here about, you know, if you could have near immortality, a really long life, even if it involved, you know, reincarnation with new bodies in some way or another, how good of a near eternity of living would that be? And I don't know, I can see some pluses to it. I think that, you know, hopefully not going to die right away, but even when I do die, I anticipate that. I think there's more interesting stuff I could have done had I had longer. So it seems like probably whatever the optimal lifespan, at least for me, is, it's longer than the 80 or so years that I'll probably have here. But is it infinite, or even as long as the heat death of our universe, or something like that? You know, I think probably we get old before
then. If you were a bad person, you would have to live a long, long time. If you were a good person, you could end yours earlier.
Do we have a question here in the back?
I'm so good.
All right, so in the sci-fi book, and this individual mentioned the quantum tape. So it came to mind that teleportation may be a possibility in the future. I don't know, but I had mentioned experience down there, you know, scientists teleporting photons and what have you. So my question is it along the same lines of, you know, say, the ghost of machine, like if I would have teleported, would that copy of me, if that were copy, would it still be me? Would it still contain my essence, my individuality, my personhood, or would it not be me? And so if it were possible for these two things that you mentioned are possible, would you put them in the same category, or are they somehow different?
Good. Yeah, I take questions about the possibility of teleportation to be closely akin to these questions. So one sort of teletransporter that people have imagined would be one where, say, I want to transport myself to Mars. And so we imagine we have a machine on Earth that carefully scans my body, sends the information to Mars. There's another machine on Mars that uses that information to build a replica of my body on Mars. And maybe even my original body is destroyed in the process. A lot of people have worried about that, basically the same worry I raised against Zimmerman, that this at best would be a way of creating a clone of me that's a lot like me, but isn't actually me. And one way of seeing that is imagine that somebody didn't actually get destroyed in the process. And so the replica was created and the original still survived. Clearly those two are different people, and why should it matter whether or not the original got destroyed in the process if the replica was going to count as that original person? So that sort of teleportation, I think, raises the same sorts of worries here. Now, there's another way that people sometimes have thought about teleportation working. So I guess in Star Trek, the way the transporter works is that basically, you know, E equals MC squared, matter and energy are supposedly interconvertible, and so the idea there is that the matter is converted into energy, sent down the transporter beam, and then reconverted into matter at the other end, so it's basically the same matter keeping its organization all the way through. And this seems like a better case to say there's the right sort of continuity, to say it is the very same individual who's emerging at the other end of the transportation process. And so that seems like a better case for transportation working, and I guess the quantum cases that people have where it's basically getting a single particle to teleport, so no hope for James Kirk yet. Those, it seems like they think it really is the very same particle rather than some replica that's a lot like the original that's appeared in the new location.
Okay, we have time for two more questions.
Has anyone ever thought about that life in terms of sort of a collective point of view, which is pretty abstract, but I suppose by virtue of evolution, we are, you know, intrinsically programmed for survival, trying to survive, and that serves, you know, that serves a purpose. But you take that away and step back, you can say that collectively we still survive kind of like a collective subconscious. Has anyone ever looked at it that way? Say, you know, maybe individually we're too preoccupied with life after death because that, you know, we're reacting to kind of an intrinsic part aspect of our brain that's hardwired, but from a bigger perspective, we're just too focused on it.
I guess the short answer to your question is I don't know of anybody to point you at who's thought about these sorts of issues. The closest I can think of is people thinking the sense in which our DNA might contain information about past environments as a consequence of evolutionary selection pressures, which, you know, and there might even be prospects for our having certain innate beliefs, like, you know, to be the most persuasive case of this might be a belief that snakes are dangerous, that it seems like pretty much everybody gets the same sort of scared response to seeing that sort of writhing shape of a snake. And this is a somewhat plausible case to say, well, that's the sort of belief that each of us develops as a consequence of having ancestors who experienced selection pressures for having these mechanisms that kept them away from snakes. And you might say, well, that's a sort of inheriting of mental states from our ancestors that we get. Does that mean our ancestors have lived on in us? Not very much, I don't think, I'm not sure. It seemed like you had ideas of collective consciousness and stuff like that, which there certainly is a lot of work and people thinking about, you know, what sense is the Dallas Philosophy Society or whatever y'all are called.
What forum?
Well, I thought, you know, when you were asking for volunteers to be on the board, it wasn't for the forum.
Yes, it's for the Dallas Philosophy Forum.
Okay, well, you called it something different. But whatever it's called, there are questions about in what sense does the forum want a new board member independently of each of the board members currently in the forum, or each of the broader members wanting a board member? Can it be that the forum itself has beliefs and desires? There's a lot of work on that sort of thing. So it seems like maybe the natural next step, if you ask about whether or not groups like the forum can have desires, is to ask, after the group disbands, can it reband and live on anew even after 3 years of being disbanded, or will you at best just have some other group that's a lot like the original but isn't the original when living on? So it seems like you could ask these questions about these collective entities. I don't know if people haven't asked them yet.
Last question.
I think I've solved it. Uh-huh. Our consciousness becomes dark energy, which is then sucked into a black hole. And by way of string theory, we're deposited into a parallel universe living in another dimension.
All right. Could be. I need a bit more evidence.
Okay, let's give a big round of applause to Dr. Fisher.